Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Leal welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Today is Friday, July 6, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for the LL Research, and Jim McCarty is her husband, who is the other part two of the three-part channeling team that brought us the Law of One. Please visit the website, llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And bringforth.org, that's bring, the number four, th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I will be asking Carla and Jim questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask Carla and Jim a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or you can join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Leal, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty of LL Research. Carla and Jim, hi, how are you doing today?
Hey.
We're doing good.
Okay.
It's
great.
Been a really beautiful week for us. We have been grandparents to two families of robins that took... It's really funny. We've made a little... nook for people who want to smoke. They can't smoke in the house, and so they'll go out and there's a little thing that holds a few cigarettes and a few matches, and it's just covered, you know, so that it'll hold all those things, and it has an ashtray, and and birds tend to want to put their nest in there, and then the smokers are going, what am I going to do?
Oh.
You know, but in this case, the robins found where was it? It was right above the door.
Right above the door, where the eaves protect it. They built it on top of the drain pipe that's connecting the roof drain pipe there, so it's secluded, and we can see it from inside. We can watch them through the glass there as they feed their babies, and they all start hopping around and eventually leave the nest.
So we just watched them leave the nest this week, and we said bye-bye to them. They graduated from our little confines.
Aww.
Out in the world.
That's cute. Do you have any outdoor cats around, or do they bother them at all?
We do. We do. We have a wicked outdoor cat. I mean, he's not wicked to people, but he loves to chase. Jim, did you tell me the other day you saw him jumping up and catching something out of a tree?
He tried. He went about 4 feet into this green hackberry tree out back, and he didn't catch anything, but I'd never seen a cat jump into a tree trying to catch dirt.
He's a beautiful cat. The striped type of cat, but it's a stripe that is sort of in between gray and brown. It's that dark ecru shade that is so difficult to capture, and he's just beautiful with it. And then he's got this incredible coloring around his eyes and his nose. It's just the most beautiful golden pink color, and he's a beautiful cat. Unfortunately, he has one unfortunate habit. And that is that if people come in for our meditation meetings and they happen to be carrying a purse or wearing a leather jacket, they must affect it with their lives.
Uh-oh. So I knew where you were going with that.
Yeah. So that's why he became an outdoor cat. And we cannot let him in because he will not.
Yeah.
He's absolutely, that's it. And that's what he wants to do. And he's got the whole universe to do it in, and he's happy as a clam. I look out the back door frequently and see him absolutely flat out on his back in this heat. Flat on his back with his arms and his legs just waving in the air. He's the happiest cat I ever saw. So he's happy to be outside. And he did lose his tail, though. That was a big problem. But he barely got away from that with his life.
Oh, dear.
A run-in with a raccoon.
Oh, a raccoon. Oh.
He was not fighting a raccoon. He was running, as you can tell.
Uh-huh.
He lost his tail.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Sounds like one of my kitties was indoors, one of my absolute beloved cats, and he made the mistake of peeing on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, we were standing right there. My husband and I were standing right there. There was absolutely no
reason for it. Look what I can do.
Yeah. And of course, he's neutered, you know.
Mm.
And, he's an outdoor kitty now.
Yeah.
But he loves it. He just has this boundless energy, and he just runs across the yard. Of course, he comes in and out a little bit, but he's primarily outside, and he just loves being outside, so he's fine.
Yeah.
He's happy. Okay, I'm going to go to our opening riff today, which is from the Aaron Kuo Dialogues, page 164. Faith precedes wisdom. You do not need to know anything. Just follow the guidance of your open heart. When you follow that guidance and you let go of all need to control and are present with whatever catalyst is there in that moment, as lovingly as you can be, then the mind ceases thinking about, grasping at, planning, and controlling. Then the mind is free to penetrate beyond thoughts and really understand at a level to which thought cannot take you. If surrender is the manifestation of faith, then courage, willpower, determination, and energy are all ingredients that make surrender possible. How much harder it is to face the unknown than the known fear. Surrender does not mean saying, I give up, and ceasing to express your energy. It means expressing your energy in a direction of love with no understanding of where you are going. You cannot foresee in your human shells where your path is taking you. You cannot know what it is that you or another needs to learn.
Okay, I was very happy to hear this morning. I greatly believe in synchronicity. And we read this morning in our morning offering. And I thought, well, how beautiful a thought is that, and how important. So I decided to use it. It's a funny thing about faith. People have a lot of trouble with what faith is. And the problem, of course, with faith is that it's too simple. It is not that it's got too many ingredients in it or that it's so hard intellectually to accomplish. It's that it is that which does not contain a feeling of knowing everything or a feeling of having it right. It simply contains the open heart and ourselves within our open hearts on our knees, offering ourselves for service. Our open heart is not a foolish heart. There are ways in which we can trick ourselves and think we're listening to the open heart when in reality we have not yet removed some strain of ego from ourselves or some strain of pride. When we do that, it is normally because somebody's asked us a question and we feel challenged, so we are defending ourselves. And there's nothing of defending ourselves to faith. It has nothing to do with defense. St. Francis was a wonderful guide to what faith is when he wrote his prayer of St. Francis, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is discord, union. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, teach me to seek not so much to be loved, but to love. To be understood, but to understand. To be consoled, but to console. For it is in releasing that we are given. It is in giving that we receive. And it is in dying that we rise to eternal life. Think about those things. Make me an instrument of thy peace. We do not need to know to be an instrument. The instrument is that which is manipulated by the hand of the master. If we're very, very lucky, and if we're very, very serious, we eventually become able to recognize the call of the master. It does not come in words. It comes from within, from deep, deep within our inmost and unconscious being. It is from the essence of that subconscious or unconscious being that faith arises. So when we wish to improve our faith, we surrender our egos. We surrender our fine words and our splendid language. We surrender even the inadvertent pomposity of a person who has read a lot of things and who can quote them back to you. Faith basically is a matter of letting go and allowing the one infinite creator to flow into our awareness from that realm which has no words, which is beyond words, from deep within us, in our hearts, so that they bubble up into our awareness from our unconscious or our subconscious, from our dreams when we're sleeping, or visions when we're awake, or as answers to prayers, which consist of the words, Lord, help, and everything in between. The great advantage we have in finding faith is that we can suggest to ourselves that we can let go of the need to know. We can let go of the need to be right. We can simply seek to be loving. And that is a very, very simple and powerful way of organizing our thoughts, what we want to share with the world. Is it brilliant intellectually? Is it dazzling with its splendid language? Is it euphuistic? Well, drop it. It's no good. Is it humble? Is it honest? Is it authentic? Does it tell of real experiences? You're on the right track. It's sort of a relearning of what it's like to know things, because all the way through college, as far as you want to go, for many professors anyway, tests are a matter of knowing things. You memorize dates, you memorize names, you memorize long lines of royalty and who was on the Spanish throne when the British were doing such and such, and finding out just sort of the map of the world at any particular time. A very wonderful series of books, if you want to do that, by the way, are the Ariel what is the last name of those people? They're so wonderful. to write the history of the world in many volumes, and it was it's just the most fine thing. But these two people, this married couple, both scholars, wrote these books in the fullness of their years, and they had intimate knowledge of, you know, exactly all of that stuff. They could pull into the warp and woof of their discussion, you know, what was happening at any one particular date in any one particular country on any one particular track. But that's not where faith will take us. Faith is the place where you lay your burdens down and you turn to the Creator as best as you can understand the Creator. And you say, help. Please fill me with your wisdom, with your love, with your ability to love. And then all else will flow as it should. Can you surrender? It takes a great deal of courage to surrender. It takes a good deal of determination as well. Because you don't want to surrender. Everything about you has been trained to know stuff. To come right out with it. Oh yes, chapter, verse, that was this, that was that. And indeed, it makes for a dazzling conversation. But how deep are we going with that? Now, there is a layer far beyond facts in which those who are seeking spiritual maturity will find help. Spiritual maturity basically takes you into the realms of the magical personality and becoming a maturing spiritual soul. And I think that this little riff from the Erin Kuo dialogues makes me so glad that we were able to get this book published and that it's out there, because I think it really is a magical book. And it certainly was for me. When I was editing it, I would pick it up to edit, and within the first paragraph, I would get some kind of guidance that I had been needing. You know, it just blapped, there it was right out there on the page. So I was very, very happy with that. Mick, do you have anything that you want to say on that?
Well, as you were talking about how we are trained to learn things that will help us pass tests and get good grades and proceed through our incarnations in that way, I was thinking about how children actually seem to have this quality of faith in more abundance the younger they are, and as the older they get, the more likely that the faith is trained out, shall we say, because we're trained to put value in something other than that faith with which we are born. I think it's a childlike quality that we're trying to reattain. And I think that in the spiritual journey, so much of what we are attempting to attain, the open-hearted love and acceptance and faith and giving and receiving, is something that our qualities of children. And unfortunately, we don't continue to value those, but it's not so much that we disvalue them as we go through our lives, but we value other things instead. And I think we forget faith, and we have to require it and become again as a little child.
That's a beautiful thought. You know, it's so true in the accessing of spiritual knowledge. You know, in the Christian church, you pray that way. You pray, you know, to become as a little child, for only those who are as little children will become those who are in the kingdom of heaven. And that's the great thing about a little child. I remember the year that it was before I had my degree, and so I wasn't a librarian. I was working as a kindergarten teacher. And I regularly set aside time for us to talk about what we believed and what we thought was funny, because the kids were incredibly alive and just brilliant in the things that they had to say, and their humor was very zen. You know, they would say yesterday is tomorrow and then go off in peals of laughter. And you know, you don't find people over the age of about 7 or 8 doing that, because they've started to be told by people, no, that's not right. And they want to get everything right and you know, do that right. So they let go of that value of releasing everything and becoming mystical. And it's a real shame.
Well, this is a very interesting topic for me, because I have a follow-up question to this. For me, faith was very elusive, and the only reason I think I was able to surrender at in certain times of my life when I was really at rock bottom, and what finally did resolve the situation was getting to that place of surrender. But then later I would wonder, well, what took me so long? You know, I kept trying this and that and, you know, trying every single thing except surrender. And I thought, oh, it's because I was trying to control the situation too much. I, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was trying to do this and that. And at the bottom of it was fear, you know, fear of letting go, because I really didn't know the answer. And it was that final surrender that finally brought the answer to whatever it was, that finally brought the situation to resolution. But I think the only way, the only reason I even finally knew to surrender was because of my brief experience as any, you know, in the Christian faith. Well, I was brought up Catholic, but then around age 20, for about 3 years, I was, I guess, what you'd call a born again Christian, and that is actually that experience I drew from that, and I got a very, very good foundation of the concept of surrender and faith from them. I didn't get it from my Catholic upbringing, and I certainly didn't get it from my childhood. So right. I have two questions. Number one, what would you suggest for someone who maybe did not have that experience in a religion such as Christianity that teaches that concept? Because if I hadn't had that experience, I don't know if I would have ever gotten to that point. And that is one of the valuable nuggets that I kept, that I'm glad I kept from that experience. And number two, what about someone, you say be as a little child, what about someone who did not have a good childhood, maybe was abused, maybe did not have a carefree childhood where they could just, you know, have fun and not have to worry about things? Because that is true in my case also. Mm-hmm. So when people say, well, be as a little child, for someone who doesn't have any frame of reference for that, how can do you have any suggestion on how someone can get to that place of surrender?
Well, I have had the most success working with people that are pretty well stuck in their brains, you know, in their intellect, by working with them along the lines of love. We all love somebody, and mostly we have the experience of being loved. And both of those experiences go beyond words. To be loved or to love someone else is just an incredible emotion. And even when it's not particularly pure, it's very strong. And so when people say, you know, well, I only believe things I can see, then I will work to get them to talk a little bit about things that they love, the people that they love, the teachers that they've had that they loved and so forth. And then I'll ask them, well, how could you prove that they were right? Are you sure that it wasn't just that you were loving them or that you were appreciating the fact that they were loving you? And generally, that will get them, because it's one of those logical jams that you get into, and it's a Chinese puzzle. You can't get back out of it. And so there's no way that somebody can say, well, no, I don't believe in love, because people have had, you know, intimate first-person knowledge of it. It may have not been all to the good. It may have been, boy, love is tough, you know, but it's there. I mean, that feeling, those emotions are there in just about everybody you talk to. So that's generally how I have addressed it in the past. it's a gentle way to address it. It doesn't presume a lot of knowledge of the other person. And it's just, you know, it's a straightforward, logical procession, you know. If the love, then, you know, then where does it come from? If you experience it, why is it not true? Why could you say that it's not true unless you could somehow prove it? And most people will kind of go with you there. Yeah, it's definitely true, whether I can, you know, adjust it or you know, defend it or whatever. It's definitely there.
You know, something I've heard from people a lot when we talk about subject of faith is, oh, that's just a Christian concept, and they just have faith because they don't have any, you know, understanding of this or that. I mean, it's a very derogatory, you know, mm-hmm. attitude that I hear. And they say, well, I don't want to live like that, you know, this blind, childlike faith, you know. And I would usually be defending the concept of faith. I'm like, no, that's one of the best things they have, you know. I wish, you know, and there were times in my life where, as I learned more, like when I discovered the Law of One and things like that, that I just, you know, I got away from that faith, and I thought, no, I want to go back to having that faith. That's a good thing. Yeah. But I don't know how to respond when they say that. I don't quite know how to, I mean, how can we put it in terms that they can relate to, that, no, it's not just, you know, letting Jesus do everything for you necessarily. It's the Creator. You don't have to be a Christian or any particular religion to acknowledge, I mean, as long as you at least believe in a Creator or your higher self or something. I mean, because they ask the question, well, what am I surrendering to? You know, I want to surrender to something. So how do you convey to them that they're surrendering to themselves, to their higher selves, the divine part of themselves?
Jim, you might have a better answer than this, but I think that my basic response is to go right to surrender and say, well, you know, I don't know if you can get this or not. You know, this may not be meaningful to you, and if so, just drop it. But here's the way I look at it, you know, and just share from that standpoint, and don't try in any way, shape, or form to be attached to whether that other person can understand you. Just lay it out there in the best way you yourself can understand to offer it, and then move on, because if the person feels that there's some attachment to their understanding you or believing what you're saying or thinking that you're right, then that puts a pressure on them. And that's not what I aim to do. I aim to support people where they are. And if where they are is profoundly and deeply in their intellect and they have no appreciation of a softer roads to the heart, then I will gladly work with them along the lines of the intellect and just see where I can go with that, you know, see what the Creator gives us, you know, to work with, because a lot of times wonderful things will happen when you least expect it. But basically, I don't find a lot of virtue in saying, well, no, I think you're wrong there. I'll try to honor what they think and work from where they think it. But I do, you know, a lot of times just say, well, if you don't feel comfortable, you know, jumping off the cliff, you know, good old the leap into faith, you know, and that beautiful Jim, who's the author I'm trying to think of, starts with an H.
I was going to say Kierkegaard.
No, it's a Swedish author. But the leap into faith is something that he wrote, and it's been translated widely, and it's really powerful. And he talks about, you know, that jump into midair. But the thing of it is, you notice after you've done it that the thin air, you know, is holding you. You're doing just fine. You're walking on air with no more difficulty than you had walking on the ground, because this is where your soul is supposed to live. So if people will try it a couple of times, then they'll discover, oh, wow, there's a lot of power in that choice. But all you can do is offer ideas like that. There's no way you can say, but listen to me, this is the right way. Well, it might not be the right way for that person. That person might have 10,000 steps to go through before he can get to letting go of those facts that are defending him, that is part of his armor. Some people are very well armored with facts, and to get them to let go of any of them and to even conceive of another way of thinking is very difficult. But I do find it, you know, a good thing to talk to people like this, because once they get it, and once they've tried it, then, of course, they flip and become the strongest, you know, exponents of this method of getting to know the Creator. Because, you know, it's a startlingly good thing that happens to us all when we do eventually put down our knowledge and ask the Creator in humility, oh, Lord, please, you know, what's next? Give me a clue.
I remember wanting that for so long, for years, and just wanting to be able to surrender and take that leap of faith. And it was terrifying to me at the time. It was absolutely terrifying. And I never did get it. It only happened because I exhausted all the other possibilities.
You have tremendous energy. I can just see you pounding at the door. Get me in here. I want faith, and I want it now. That's one of the best ways to get it.
And it was only because nothing else worked. Finally, I was so desperate that it finally happened for me. And wow, I'm like, gosh, this is kind of fun. Why didn't I do this earlier?
This is not so bad.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a really good topic there. Okay, we can be reached. If anyone would like to call us live, we can be reached at 646-595-2294. That's 646-595-2294. Be sure and hit the one key if you'd like to ask a question or just join the conversation. You're welcome to do that. And I'm going to move on to our next question. Well, a question from LSD Saved Me. Cool name there. Would like some help understanding the following quote from Ra, Session 5.2, regarding steps which we should accomplish in becoming effective healers. Okay, this is a quote from Ra. The third discipline of the mind is a repetition of the first, but with the gaze outward towards the fellow entities that it meets. In each entity there exists completeness. Thus, the ability to understand each balance is necessary. When you view patience, you are responsible for mirroring in your mental understanding patience/impatience. When you view impatience, it is necessary for your mental configuration of understanding to be impatience. We use this as a simple example. Most configurations of mind have many facets, and understanding of either self polarities or what you would call other self polarities can and must be understood as subtle work. LSD Save Me says, I find this extremely confusing and I'm having trouble coming to terms with it. If I mirror someone's impatience in my mind, does this mean I should feel impatience too?
Well, Jim has so much of a better skill than I for being terse. And this is a somewhat long bit of information to talk about the balancing exercises and how you work on that once a day if you possibly can. So I'd like to turn it over to you if that's all right.
Okay. Patience and impatience were used as an example of how any catalyst or experience that makes a mark on your mind during the day can be used in evening meditation in order to balance the self. And what Ross suggested in this particular instance was that if during the day you have noticed that you have been impatient and you feel that that is something that needs balance, then in your meditation, you can relive that experience in which you were impatient. And you can allow that feeling of impatience to grow within you until it's very large and very impatient. And then there is an opportunity to let that go for just a second and let the balance of patience come into your being as well. And let it grow until it equals the impatience that you originally experienced and have been meditating on. So that eventually what you have in the work on this impatience and patience quality is a balance between the two. And then you, as a third part of this balancing exercise, accept yourself for having both of these qualities within you. Not judging yourself at all for either of them. Not patting yourself on the back for being patient and not being angry or sad that you're impatient. But you accept yourself for having both of these qualities as means by which the Creator can know itself in you and means by which you can know another portion of the Creator. So you can do this with anything that happens. It can be anger, anger slash love. It could be being in a hurry or being slower and being more relaxed. It can be anything that happens during the day that leaves a mark in your mind, something that you remember. And because you remember it, then that is a signal that there's something there that you can balance. So this is just a technique that Ross suggested that we can use in order to find a balance. And the whole idea of the balance is to be able to accept ourselves as we are, as perfect portions of the Creator, seeking to know the Creator, seeking to know ourselves. So, and it can be done with anything that happens during your daily round of activities.
Okay, at what point do you begin to shift from one to the other? Like, at what point do you feel that you're self-filled with impatience, then you switch to patience?
When you feel that there's no more expansion of that quality that is possible. You've gotten as much of it in there, as much impatience or anger or whatever you're working with, and then you just kind of let it go. And then there just seems to be a natural calling to its opposite that occurs within you. It's like you plant a little seed, like, okay, now what? And what next is the balancing quality of patience for impatience or love for anger and so forth.
Do you think maybe it's a magnetic thing? Like, is the more you're filling yourself with the impatience or whatever it is, that it's actually kind of like magnetically pulling the patience, which is the very quality that you're looking for at that moment?
I think that's a good way of describing it. I think each of us knows just at the very fiber of our being, the foundation of our being, what the opposite quality of whatever it is that we're experiencing is, and it's easy to want to be patient rather than impatient. So as we're going through this exercise and feeling the great impatience and the agitation that that causes within us, our anguish is almost calling out for patience to come to us. And when we release the impatience, having blown it up as much as we can and felt all of its fury within us, then the patience is called, and it comes, and it's like a healing salve, a balm to our wound, and it balances us.
This is very similar to what I was taught when I was trained in rebirthing. We did this breathing exercise to access the negative emotion first, because the idea was that the negative emotion was actually stored in the cellular memory. And we had the person do this accelerated, rapid breathing, and the negative emotion, whether it was fear or anger or hatred or whatever, would come to the surface, come bubbling up, and we would actually have them like hit a pillow or something and just immerse themselves in that feeling of anger for just a few minutes, not very long, just temporarily to access it. And then we would replace it with something positive, with positive affirmations, you know, the total opposite of what they had been feeling. So I guess it goes without saying, you want, when you're doing this technique, it's more of a meditative exercise, and maybe, I guess, if the person feels the need to express that anger, do it in a harmless way, you know, hit a pillow or a punching bag or something. And
my favorite is throwing eggs at a tree. I have, when I was truly furious, expended a full dozen.
Oh, that sounds like a
lashes, you know. And then,
you
of
know,
course, I had to get the hose out and wash it off because it doesn't wash off by itself.
I think I'd do that better than throwing plates.
It probably is.
That's a great idea, Carla. I wish I'd thought of that. I always use plates. They were very rewarding, the sound of the crashing.
Oh, man, yeah. Throwing the egg is a very good thing. You have to apologize beforehand that you're not actually eating it. But, you know, you're giving me a way to express myself. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. There's something about throwing something and having it break. But as long as it's not hurting anybody or anything, obviously. But, yeah, plates make a great mess. I don't recommend that at all.
Well, no, and then you have to go through cleaning it up.
Exactly.
And, you have to find a way to express it where you're not so involved afterwards.
It does get something out, though. It does get that.
Well, it
anger.
Does, and I think there's you know, that the primal scream, you know, is a good thing if you feel it coming on. You know, find a place where you can indulge and just let it go. But I don't think that it's all that easy sometimes to find that place where the other side of patience being impatience will come, because we're not used to that. So one thing that you can do to help that is to slow the process down. Like, you can spend 2 weeks hating it, whatever it is. And then you spend another 2 weeks involved in loving it, whatever it is. You go back and forth until you are finally able to feel both, and it's a genuine feeling of both, and you see how you could feel this way and that way about whatever it is. And then you've got it. You just hold those two in comparison. It's like thinking about our very existence here. Our very existence is one of polarity, endless polarity, polarity on polarity on polarity. We fill them out every single time we, you know, go to the doctor or enter a school or, you know, what is your name? What is your birth date? Are you male or female? Are you old or young? Are you this or that? You know, and you get so many polarities. And so these little polarities, it's not surprising that we have both polarities in us, the very things that we are all things. And that is so simple as to really pretty much confuse everybody. It's very confusing to think, what do you mean we're all things? Look at me, I am not all things. I mean, this is pretty obvious. You know, I am not, and then you go, okay, I am not a male, I am not tall, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and describe all the ways that you're not the opposite. But then if you're tall, if you're brave as a lion, then you're tall that way, you know, and so forth and so on. So, you know, there are ways in which all of us are strong and powerful and brave, and then there are ways in which all of us are completely, you know, bitten with fear and needing to go find a place to hide. So that's it's just, we live in a density that is made up of things and their opposites. The world of 10,000 things, and no matter where you go, you can find opposition, you can find parallel truths, you can find the same truth coming from a daisy that comes from a mathematical equation. That's what what was that guy did that found the quarks and stuff? Not the quarks. I'm not talking about quarks here. I'm talking about,
oh, recently in the newspaper, the boson particle, the the God particle.
Maybe the God. I don't know. Maybe that's a good example of it. I hadn't seen that. You can get down to the very innermost mathematics concerning being human, and you find mathematical equations that describe a certain state, and it repeats over and over and over again. It's fascinating. But I'm not.
Oh, are you referring to Nassim Haramein, maybe, and his work with the fractal universe? And
there you go, fractals.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm kind of stumbling around trying to put my name on it. Yeah, fractals. You know, this goes so deep into our very cells. Every cell of our body is this creature that is subject to opposition and to unity. And if you'll think about it in logic, if you had all things in opposition, then you would have to have all things in unity.
It seemed to me when I read this that Ra was giving us the recipe for acceptance. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, what is acceptance and why is acceptance so important? When we're in the density of choice, when we're clearly, the task is to choose love, then where does acceptance come in? And to me, it seemed like that's the way to accept the so-called dark aspects of our being, and only by accepting them can we make our choice into love and into unity and wholeness.
I think that's right. I have had so many conversations with bits of my personality that were really dark and mean, and I'd find that in myself, and I go, oh, good grief, that's worse than the last one I saw. You know, and then, you know, really settle down to it and really see that this was a part of me, and then once I got it pretty well understood, you know, that as well as I could understand myself as to what this was about, then I would ask this characteristic of myself to work for me instead of against me. You know, this is the light. The light has never been overcome by darkness, and it never will. And it would really help me out if you would work with this light as well as with me, and give me those grittier emotions, because a lot of times you need gritty emotions in this life in order simply to persevere in the way that you want to go and to have the moral and the physical fiber to stick with what you're doing, whatever it might be, whatever you believe.
Do you think it's fully forgiveness if one hasn't really faced those grittier aspects of their being? In other words, our tendency is to just sweep it under the rug. Oh, mm-hmm. Gosh, I don't want to think about that. Oh, no, I had this conflict with this person. Let's not talk about it. Let's be all nice and, you know, warm fuzzies, and it's all peachy. But is that really forgiveness when it's just swept under the rug like that?
You know, it's not forgiveness. But see, the sad part is, as long as you're not forgiving somebody else, guess who else you're not forgiving?
Uh-huh.
And so you can pretty much look at anything where you absolutely are not going to forgive that, and you go, okay, where is that in me that's gotten so so full of pride and ego that I think I know what this person doesn't? And if I really sit down and think about it, it doesn't take very long usually, because usually, you know, the disagreements between us are fairly simple. You know, you made me unhappy, you hurt me, you hurt my feelings, you know, and therefore I will, you know, fill in the blank. I will punish you, I will ignore you, I will seek your understanding, I will ask what was wrong, you know. And some of these are, you know, closer to the right thing to do than the others. And the closer they come to a loving acceptance of both yourself and the other person, then the closer you come to being able to ask the right questions to straighten things out and get things going in the right direction between two people. The interactions between two people tend to be full of judgment, because we haven't finished judging ourselves. And, of course, every little ounce of judgment that you put into your dealings with another person drives a wedge between you and another person. So just dealing from person to person, it's really much more helpful that you are in support of this person than that this person understand you, or that this person think you're right, or any of those things. The important thing, if you can't find any other way to hook into it, that person, is simply to find ways to support that person as that person is. And not bother to mention that, you know, I would never do anything like that, but merely say, you know, well, if that's the way you want to do it, you know, I will support you. I mean, unless it's, you know, it's against the law or something. It's very shadowy what we do with other people. Some people are just pure joy to work with. Other people are spiny and thorny and difficult. And yet, if you can make contact within that bed of thorns, all the roses come out and there's no thorns there at all. It's doing that, of course, first you forgive the other person. Now, secondly, you need to forgive yourself. And once forgiveness all around is sustained, then you will be more effective than you were before at communicating with this other person. Sometimes there's no way to get closer to that person than that, just simply supporting that person. But, you know, if that person hasn't had a good smile and a good pat on the back lately, that simple means the support is very helpful.
And sometimes in a conflict, the other person has chosen to not resolve it. They don't want to talk about it, and you don't have any choice but to honor that and deal with it in yourself and attempt to balance the aspect of that other person.
That's really when it gets hard, and what you were asking about is how do you do this when you don't have the help of the other person? Of a really good book that I found years ago is a book on how to work with another person. It's by Ken Kies. Jim, what's the name of that book?
Handbook to Higher Consciousness.
Yeah, Handbook to Higher Consciousness. It actually gives you methodology for dealing with people that is powerful and really almost cruel. It depends on whether or not you're ready for the really rough stuff, you know, as far as working with yourself. But what they suggest, one thing that they suggest, is that you and the person with whom you are dealing tie yourselves together. And
wow.
That way, yeah, within the you know, framework of their week at Ken Kies's Institute, you would be tied together and you would have to work together to do everything, take showers, go to the bathroom, eat, everything. And of course, like most things that are designed to break through a wall, some people have firmer walls than others. Some people find this very, very helpful. Other people find it obnoxious. But it definitely works. Another thing that Ken Kies suggests that I have found to be very slow but also very good is working with the other person with whom there is a misunderstanding and being required to start every sentence with I. I am creating that I feel badly at what you were saying, and you express different things that you feel. And then that person will come back to you with, well, I am creating. And then they talk to you about how they feel. But it can never be, well, you did such and such, or, you know, like that. It's always, I am creating. And that, too, I thought was a powerful way to learn to be patient with yourself and with other people.
Interesting. I think I have that book on the bookshelf. I'll have to dig that out. Okay, we just have a couple of minutes left. I have a very quick follow-up question. Well, I don't know if it's quick, but all of this discussion has reminded me of a particular session from Kuo, I believe, and I remember that they gave a technique for transforming and transmuting negative emotions, and it had to do with really, really immersing yourself in that negative emotion and really feeling it in your body and then bringing it up to the level of the heart. And I remember when I read that, I visualized like one of those Play-Doh things where you put the clay in and you press it down and you get the shape out. It was like you bring it up into the heart. And I remember Kuo said it was that the heart was actually a mechanism for transforming that negativity, whether it was anger or whatever, transforming it into love. I have not been able to find that session. Do you remember that session?
Nope, I sure don't. But I can fish around for it.
But do you remember
that? What I generally do is there's a Google search, meaning that once you get into our LLresearch.org site, you can click on search, and a Google search will come up, and you type in the word that you want and just how specific you want it to be, you know, any word, that precise word, you know. And then they will give you anything on the site in which that word has been used. So you might be able to find it that way.
Yeah, it would help if I knew the words.
I was extremely impressed with Ian because he got that together from freeware that's available from, but you have to do a lot of work to get it working on your site.
If you can remember a phrase, it makes it much more accessible.
Okay. So that particular technique doesn't ring
heart.
A bell, though? Yeah. But I mean, that the technique at all, doesn't ring a bell? Just bringing it up into the heart and...
Oh, yeah, it rings a bell very much, but as far as where and when that was channeled, there have to be at least a dozen people that know more about my channeling than I do, because I'm not really around when I'm channeling. So I wake up and everybody's talking about it, and I'm going, gee, I'm going to have to read that, you know, because I don't really retain much.
Right.
It may be conscious channeling, but it's not very conscious. It's extremely slow.
Well, I'm actually more interested in what any comments you might have about the technique itself. I mean, the session I can look for later, but just in reference to what we were talking about the negative emotions, is that something you think you could work with in conjunction with this other technique about balancing?
I think if you have a picture of yourself and you say you want to work with color, then you can sort of envision this problem that you have, and it's vibrating in a certain color, you know, because of the shadow of its difficulty. And it you know, depending on what it's about, whether it's a problem you have with yourself or with one other person to whom you're not married, which is orange ray, or whether it's your wife, your mother, you know, the family, the birth family, the marriage family, it calls on certain things. And so you can envision those and just sort of ask to see just where the bruise is, the pain, the swelling in that color. And at that point, you know, once you get some kind of envisioning going, you just ask it to rise up into the green. You know, if you're, it's good to know the numbers in sequence, you know, the Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. It's good to know that, because that way you've got that resource there, and you can say, oh boy, my green ray is doing fine, but my yellow ray is having a lot of trouble. So let's go back down there and allow the light to shine through there and see if we can just sort of illumine that so that it comes on up. You know, let's ask it to come on up. Let's ask it to rejoin the human race. And you can do a lot with that. It's a lot of prayer time with that. And you can pray to the Creator or to your higher self or however you pray. I don't know. There is no end of ways that you can pray. I once got my mother to start prayer. This is in her middle age when she'd had a hard time with alcohol, and she'd finally gotten off the alcohol, and she was a recovering alcoholic. But she said she couldn't pray. And so I told her, I found out that the problem was that she had no feeling that anybody was listening. So I told her to pray to her bedpost, because she had a bed with tall bedposts on the bottom as well as on the top, but she could look right at the bottom. And I said, look at that bottom bedpost and pray to it and talk to it and give it your troubles. And it wasn't 2 weeks, and she came back and she was glowing, and she said, I've learned how to pray. My bedpost talked back to me. And then I realized it wasn't the bedpost, of course, but I mean, that was the breakthrough, was that she was able to talk to something, some little particle that was real on some level. and she could talk to that, and you know, kind of like even hold on to the bed, to the bedpost as she was talking, which she did. So I mean, you just have to be creative and try to figure out. You know, mother was a teacher. She's passed on to her reward now, which has got to be a wonderful one. And the way she taught and everything, I thought that this might be a way that, you know, she was very, you know, in this world of 10,000 things. So I figured, well, the bedpost is right there. Let's try that. And it worked. So, I mean, there's no end to what you can try if you're creative. And no two people work the same way. I have a feeling it's time to go now.
It is. We're still recording, but our live listeners, well, they can catch the rest on in the recording.
I want to thank number 317 and number 951. We've had here. It's been real pleasant. Thank you so much, you two. It's been great to be hanging out here with somebody. And the rest
please
send in your questions, because we're getting a little low on them. We'd love to hear what you ask about. Not that I know anything, or that Jim does, or that Monica does, but we'll start, you know, the conversation going, and maybe something good will happen there.
Yes, please do send in your questions. You can do that at bringforth.org. And I think maybe they can still hear us, because they still are showing they're on the phone. So hopefully they can still hear us. Carla, I just have one last quick question, and I know this is going to get recorded. Being that our opening riff came from the Aaron Kuo dialogue, I know you have that book in your store, in the llresearch.org bookstore, and I'll have to pick that up. I actually don't have that book, but maybe next week we can go into – I'd like to ask what is the basis for that book, because I think that's a sleeper. I think a lot of people don't know about that book. They don't know too much about it. And
it'll be fun to talk about it. I think that'll be great, Monica. Let's do that.
Yeah, maybe we can do that. But just for now, anybody that's still listening, you can find that at the bookstore at llresearch.org. And thanks so much for listening. We will be here next Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. And if you've enjoyed the show, please check out llresearch.org and bringforth.org. That's bring4th.org. Thanks, and we'll talk to you next week.